It's so such a great thing to be back here again today with Ryan. And Ryan has an update on his project and on how things are going in life. And I'm really looking forward to hearing more about it. So I'm going to let you drive for a while, Ryan.
Sounds good. Thank you, Karen. I told Karen originally I was going to talk about something, and then I just told her right before we hit record that I'm like doing something else. So, this. So to catch anybody up who hasn't listened to the previous stuff, I am a software developer who became really interested in memory networks, like the brain, and how transformation happens, how healing happens. And through that, I am studying counseling. And I've just been doing my own kind of personal research into memory and networks and healing. And I just wanted to talk about all that. And so, it's hard to know where to start. So I got interested in this notion of memory reconsolidation about a year and a half ago, through a researcher named Bruce Ecker, who Karen has interviewed. There's a lot of neuroscience research into what they call memory consolidation, destabilization, and then reconsolidation. And basically, I mean, it's just that, like, we're processing information, we store it in a certain way, right? And obviously, we can't store all the information. Like, we don't have nearly enough capacity for that. So we're like compressing the information down to something, we're storing it somehow. And then for a long time, we thought that, well, once it's stored, it's basically stuck like that, you know? But then around like the 90s, we discovered plasticity and we thought, okay, well, maybe things can change, but they change rather slowly, right? But then maybe like 20 years ago or something, we started realizing, like, oh, actually, there's some manner in which memory networks can change more rapidly, like very rapidly, you know, and this can actually apply to memory networks that are controlling like anxiety, for example. And so, you know, Bruce Ecker is a counselor who started getting really interested in, you know, what is it that is like, sometimes he would see deep, really transformational stuff happen with his counseling clients, and he was like, what's going on there? So he started like looking for the patterns, and he discovered that neuroscience of memory reconsolidation, and he connected the dots and he realized, oh, there's a ton of therapeutic benefit here. And so that's kind of the lay of the land right now. So Ecker's work has really started spreading a lot. Or I mean, not started. I mean, it's been spreading, I guess, for a while in the counseling world, and people are starting to connect the dots and realize, like, oh, okay, when deep transformation happens in counseling, it seems to follow this pattern of memory reconsolidation. And basically, the way it works is, you know, you have your memory network that has stored something. And as far as we can tell, memory, like a major purpose of it is to predict, right? And so Ecker frames it as, okay, you've got this memory network that's making predictions about the world. And as long as those predictions are mostly accurate, then it's just kind of cruising along doing its thing. But when it encounters one that is a major prediction error, you know, like there's some anomaly happens basically, and the anomaly can't be accounted for. Suddenly, that's when the memory network destabilizes and goes, oh, wait, hold on, what's going on here? And then it might attempt to kind of make sense of that anomaly and then reorganize according to some new structure or pattern or set of principles or whatever, right? And, you know, the way that can be beneficial therapeutically is, okay, if you have a memory network that is predicting, you know, every time I share my thoughts, I get shamed, you know, like maybe you grew up in a family like that. A prediction error might be when that part of the network realizes, oh, wait, actually, there's these other people in my life that don't shame me, right? And as long as those things are kept separate, then they never interact, they never transform each other, right? And so the goal then in counseling is to have those parts of the brain talk to each other. For the part that thinks, oh, I'm always going to be shamed, it needs to be able to talk, it needs to be able to dialogos with the part that already knows, hey, no, I'm not always shamed, you know? And if those parts can start talking to each other, then they transform each other, right? And then, you know, the
How
anxiety can.
beautiful, almost makes me want to cry.
Yeah, it is. It's very, very, very powerful, right? And it kind of bugs me that it's still just stuck in academia, because academia is so incredibly boring and tedious and pretentious. And it's like, no, this is a very exciting idea. This is the pattern of transformation, right? This is the pattern of healing in a very generic sense, right? And that's kind of what
Also,
I've.
actually, the pattern of art and the pattern of science and the pattern of life, if life is being lived towards truth.
Exactly. So that perfect. You get it. You get it. And so I want to segue into that and show you kind of what I'm working on in that sense, because I want to do some work in this field that's not necessarily going to be, I think, bleeding edge research, but I want it to be translating all this stuff into something that people can really grasp easily, and like normal people, not like academic researchers and stuff. And so I've got this website that right now I'm just calling reconsolidate.me. It's just like a junky academic looking website, right? And it just has some stuff that I'm working on. But I want to start by showing off this thing. Well, before I show it, let me show you. Are you familiar with Conway's Game of Life,
Yes.
Karen? Okay,
Yes.
great. And so for the viewers who aren't familiar, basically it's like you can have this grid of black and white squares and have the grid operating according to a set of principles where each square, like it's almost like every frame, it's updating and doing something, and each square is going to look at its surrounding neighbors. And so if you've got one square in the middle, you've got eight surrounding it, and so it'll just take those eight pieces of information and decide whether it's going to turn on or off, right? And Conway found that he could have this really simple set of rules, and it would lead to this really complex, beautiful, emergent behavior. There's all kinds of weird stuff like this. Like, this is fascinating to me. Like, you can actually make this thing work fractally, where this is a whole bunch of tiny squares, but it's actually simulating the game of life at a larger scale, right? And so you can get really interesting emergent behavior through this, right? And so essentially what I've done here is I've said, okay, what if I can make a game of life that will you can set any set of rules on it. And so let me just hit randomize, right? And so it just set it to some random rules, not just like Conway's, but like each square now is deciding stuff based on what's up here. And it's complicated. It doesn't really matter that much. I'll describe it in like normal terms as I go along. But what's interesting is when you hit randomize, like there's so many different combinations of what can happen here. Some of them, you see these little blobs that are morphing around. Sometimes it just sort of decays into like nothingness, Sometimes it stabilizes somewhat. You get all kinds of different behavior from this, right? And just for the record, like the red, green, blue up here, it's just controlling the different colors. Like each little pixel is like it has a red, green, and blue component. And so that's what the rules are, but it doesn't really matter. That's just to make it like look prettier, But so in this case, you can see that like, okay, there's this blob that's forming, and it's slowly transforming the network, right? And it's not because information is like it looks like movement, but what's actually happening is the things at the edges are making decisions based on, okay, am I either going to turn pink or blue at this point? And now that the whole network has transformed, this is kind of probably the end state of it permanently. Like none of the cells are going to make any further changes at this point, right? And so, you could spend all day hitting randomize and seeing all kinds of different stuff, but what I've been looking for is like, okay, what are sets of rules that lead to, behavior that's more interesting than this? Because this is like, it's not really that interesting. And what I've found is there are some sets of rules that do different kinds of stuff. And so I'll just show a few of them. Like this one, it decays into these little squares, right? And so it stabilizes at this point. Like at this point, it's not really going to change any further, right? This is very similar, except instead of squares, it's just like little blobs, right? And so you'll see it's like going to slowly morph into this. And the blobs are sort of like mixing with each other, almost like watercolor on a canvas or something. You know? But then you start getting some stuff like this sometimes, where this is more like actual, like, this one has been one of the more interesting ones to me because you can start to see something that looks like information getting transferred around, you know? And so if you look for, are you able to see my mouse, Karen?
Yes.
Okay, great. So, you know, you can kind of see sometimes like, okay, there's information that's like transferring around over here, and it'll transform little blobs of color from one color to another color, right? And there's a lot of movement. Eventually, it'll kind of stabilize into something. But this is kind of the pattern that's in my head that represents like what is happening with memory reconsolidation, right? Where somehow memory or, yeah, somehow information is getting transferred around. And when that information gets transferred to a certain spot, it can actually transform that whole region rapidly in a certain way. So let me show this again, and maybe you can see better examples of it as it's going, right? So at first, it's just chaos. It's just kind of undifferentiated chaos, and it starts self-organizing into whatever this is, right? And as it's self-organizing, it's actually, you know, transforming little different areas. And so I'm noticing like this over here is kind of wanting to move that way a bit. This was kind of blackish, but now I see this is moving over. You know, I mean, you can see it all over the place, right? Another version of
I want to make a comment here just for people who might be watching this who hear this idea about self-organizing criticality. When it gets to a certain point, it just starts to organize itself. And I think that's all very true, but in this case, you have a rule. This is operating according to a rule.
Yes.
And what's interesting to me is that the rule is based on each cell understanding its context.
Yes.
Right? So right. The cell has an identity and it understands its context and its relationship to the other cells. And right. That's what's driving this thing here.
And it's like long term, I can also add things to the model where it's like, okay, how accurately are the cells perceiving the information, you know? Because right now, for the most part, I just have it to where, okay, they can correctly see what's around them. But you could also model it to where there's distortion, you know, and we'll get to that later. Another interesting one I want to show is this, where it's very similar to the last one, but instead of being little squares, it's kind of more interesting shapes moving around, right? And sometimes you can even get little, like, spirals where it's almost like a little vortex where information passes around and gets like launched in a certain direction, you know, just very interesting behavior like that.
Yeah, that one's very intriguing.
Yeah.
Looks like Native American symbolism or something.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff you can see emerge from this kind of stuff. And, you know, I mean, and this is very small. I mean, you can imagine if this was modeled on a much larger scale. I mean, there's no telling what you would see, right? So one question I had was like, okay, so in a case like this, you can end up with things that are like fairly stable, right? Like this for the most part is probably going to stay how it is, like this big circle thing. Unless something eventually kind of hits it from a certain angle, like this might end up transforming it, you know, or like maybe this. But the question I've been trying to answer is like, what sets of rules are going to lead to the maximum amount of both movement and stability? Or you know, what kinds of rules can kind of control the relationship between movement and stability, if that makes sense? And what was cool is I was able to like think about this in an abstract sense by thinking about communities. I was like, okay, well, what makes the best community? You know, it seems to be when you have people that are seeing things from opposite perspectives, but they're listening to each other, you know, and they're being gracious towards each other. And as I thought about like, okay, how can I take that idea and transfer it into like this language, right? And what I came up with was this, the one that you saw at first when I first opened it. So this is basically the only version I have found that has like a very high degree of stability and a high degree of movement. And it's what I just described. It's essentially me modeling like, you've got this belief set A and belief set B. Basically, each little cell is randomly assigned one of those at the beginning. And so they're all operating according to one of those sets of principles, right? And so on the left, belief set A, the principle is okay, look for the most extreme colors first. Belief set B is look for the least extreme colors first, like the most gray, basically. But then they're alternating. So it's like, okay, belief set A is like, okay, let me look for the most extreme, but then look for the most moderate of those. And then of those, look for the most extreme, and of those, look for the most moderate. And it's kind of whittling down towards the middle, you know? And the other one's doing the same, but it's starting with the most moderate, and then of those, let's look at the most extreme, you know? And as those things are interacting together, it leads to this, which I find super interesting. Not because I can like prove anything about it per se, but it matched my intuitions so well that like there's one set of rules that's leading to maximum amount of harmony and variety and movement and stability. You know what I mean?
It's the Constitution of the United States, basically.
Yeah, I
That
mean.
was the original vision of the founding fathers was exactly that. Even if you had very disparate ideas, because they had these structures in place that would protect the system from going too far one direction or another, then you would have stability. I mean, that's this in the Constitution, the stability arises out of the checks and balances and the separation of powers and all of these things, a lot of which have been affected or to some extent destroyed by subsequent
Yeah, it's like when you start losing those inherent balances, then you have extremes, right? And I think that's kind of what we're seeing. It feels like in the current, American political landscape, we're like oscillating between extremes, and there's really not a lot of balance. Like the balancing in institutions, or the institutions that are supposed to do the balancing, are maybe weakened or not respected, or they've just been dissolved or whatever. And so yeah, I mean, you can see. And this is why I'm interested in Gabe Stuckey's work, because what he's been doing, a lot of it revolves around this nature of self-balancing, right? And so it seems like, okay, take this idea, put a pin in it, let me show you something else, right? And so this is a different kind of little project.
Before we move on to that, let me just ask a couple of questions here. When you first started talking, you talked about memory reconsolidation. I had a couple of thoughts. One was, is this anything at all like, like when you have to defrag a computer? I haven't had to do that for, I've had a Mac for years, so I haven't had to do it for years, but I used to have to do it. Once a month or so. And the way my husband explained that to me was that the computer sort of farms out its memory into many different apps and different places on the computer. Maybe not the apps, I don't know. Different parts of the computer, the memory gets farmed out. And then sometimes it just gets too distributed. And when you defrag, you're drawing everything back up into the basic memory again, so that then it can start distributing out again later on. I don't know. That's probably a very bad way of describing
I
the
mean,
thing.
yeah, that's basically it. So defragging was relevant when you had memory was accessed by like a physical needle that had to move around, right?
Oh, okay. So this is why it's been a while since I've done it.
Exactly, because
Older
now
technology.
a lot of our memory systems no longer require that physical movement. It's entirely electronic. And so then it doesn't really matter, because you can have one piece of information over here, and the next piece of information could be over here, and it doesn't matter because it's the same amount of time to access everything, right?
Well, the reason it made me think about that is how our body sort of farms memories out into our muscles and,
Yes.
right? And
Yeah.
neurons show up in many different parts of the body. So,
Yeah, and I think we can probably get to that later, but like Yeah, yes, that very much matches the kind of thing I'm working on, especially as it relates to mind-body relationship, because there seems to be quite a substantial amount of interaction between left and right and forward and backward. And as we've talked about in the past, different postures relating different emotions and all kinds of stuff, you know, embodied cognition, yeah, relates probably in some manner metaphorically to that notion of fragmentation, you know.
So then also you were talking about the consolidation, the destabilization, and the reconsolidation. And the picture that popped into my head was, is that kind of like the whole and then the parts and then the whole again?
Yeah, because there's this
Because,
notion
so let me just tell you where my head is going is back to Dorothy Sayers and the mind of the maker, the whole idea, and then the energy is the breaking down of the parts, the working out over time with all the parts, and then the power is once the whole has been reconsolidated, manifested, then the power is in the transmission that can come horizontally from that manifestation. So I was thinking maybe the consolidation is like the idea, the original idea, the destabilization is in some sense the outworking of the idea over time through division up into the parts. And then the reconsolidation is the regathering of the whole so that you have the idea now manifested in substance in the material world. So that it can interact with other people, and so that the message can be conveyed horizontally through the culture.
I think that makes sense. I mean, what I thought about as you were talking about that was, yeah, it seems that something like energy is required to trigger a breaking apart. And once the breaking apart has happened, there's this kind of like chaotic state for a while, but it's going to naturally morph into stability again, right? So you could apply that idea to like chemistry, right? Like a chemical reaction is basically memory reconsolidation. But not applied to neurons, it's applied to atoms, right? But and see, this is why this is exciting to me because I think memory reconsolidation is, we're currently researching it mostly as it applies to like literal neural networks. But I think we could think of it as a fundamental emergent property of any network of relationships between anything, if that makes sense. And so we could think of it in physics, in chemistry, in biology, in cognition, you know, anytime you've got different things that are interacting with each other according to sets of rules that are either causing pulling together or pushing away, then you're gonna naturally, I think, get something like memory reconsolidation. And we'd probably call it something different at that point, but it's the same set of principles, right? You know. And then you start thinking about, okay, like in chemistry, you can get some really massive memory reconsolidations, like the atomic bomb, you know. You're sending energy in just the right way into something that causes huge destabilization, right? And then it all reconsolidates in some new manner, right? Now, and I think that's an important thing to understand is that this stuff is really powerful, but if you, the closer you get to the center of something, the more power is going to get unleashed, the more destabilization happens, and the more transformation happens. And that transformation can be very good or very bad, right? And so I think there is quite a bit of danger in all this stuff. And you know, we'll get to that in this conversation probably. Does that kind of line up with what you were talking about at all?
Well, I mean, I just see lining up everywhere. So the memory reconcile. I was thinking about this yesterday. I was listening to a Jonathan Peugeot, so good about fairy tales, and how fairy tales are the structure of reality, basically. And He used three words. He talked about attention, memory, and transmission. And so I'm always trying to fit everything together. So in my mind, I'm thinking attention, memory, transition. Attention is the focus. Maybe that's the idea. The attention and the idea are very related to each other because the quality of attention determines the quality of the world that opens up to you. And so you have the idea and then the memory. And I'm trying to think, how would memory work as an outworking of energy, like an artist, you know, painting one stroke at a time? And then I realized that in order for that to work, when you're painting, you have an idea in your mind, but every time you lay down a stroke, you've changed the context. And so now the next stroke has to relate not only to what's in your mind now, looking at the painting, but what was originally in your mind. So that's the memory aspect of it. And then the context, the new context that's been created, is creating a new memory. So you're constantly looping this memory back to the original memory, but then that memory is getting shifted and changed by the continuing changes in the context. And that process takes place all throughout the whole painting.
Yes.
So this is why I've told you in the past that one of the things that I have to do when I'm painting is to be able to get back to where I can see the pattern clearly again. I actually have to add chaos in order to shift things enough to where I can see the pattern again to get back to the original memory of what the original vision was. And I think it's something like that. So you have the attention and then the memory. And then once the painting is completed, now you have the transmission. The transmission is the communication of what has, after this transformation has taken place, then you have the transmission of that communication, which can take place amongst, you know, the people that are viewing this or seeing it, or relating with the person who's been reconsolidated.
That's really interesting. Like I, you know, I'm not much of an artist yet, or at least I don't think of myself as one, but with what you're describing is there's a piece of art, like a painting is it has a life, it's moving towards something, but according to, the idea, the original set of principles or rules or whatever, right? Or maybe the rules are different from the starting idea. I don't know. Because the rules are the balance and the proportion and all that stuff you talk about, right? But then the idea is, what am I trying to put out there?
Well, I'm struggling with myself, because I saw a email that Glenn sent to Gabe. Glenn and Gabe are going to have a conversation on my channel, and we may or may not videotape it. We may or may not record it. But what Glenn was saying is that every computational structure is responding to a language. So maybe it's more of a language than a rule set. So it maybe the language of painting, let's say, the language is something that is subliminal to the artist. The art's not consciously thinking about unity and harmony and contrast and all those things. But because of the water that we swim in, and because of being made in the image of God, and God has made us to be creators who can recognize his beauty when we see it, when we come up against it in the world, we can recognize his beauty. And then we subliminally understand what it takes to recreate that kind of beauty. And what that is some kind of language that has to do with repetition and variation and gradation and balance and well, all those things. So, it's kind of a language.
Yes. And I think I'm, so I'm still trying to think about how to talk about this. There's things that I have in my head that I've seen that are very compelling to me, that feel like they can connect a lot of dots, but they also feel like they can connect too many dots, you know? I mean,
I fully understand.
The atomic bomb, you know? And Gabe's work is this for me, you know, because it's like I can see how Gabe's work ties so many things together. But I've also seen, okay, well, what Gabe is doing has a lot of parallels with like Kabbalah, like Jewish mysticism, right? And that stuff, it's the same thing. It's very, very powerful. It's very interesting. It's looking into the depths of reality, but like there's massive danger there. There's massive danger with the atomic bomb. These things that connect all stuff together is like, it can either be, you know, connecting it in a way that is pointing towards God or away from God. And that seems to be the polarity, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're bringing everything together. It's like you're either getting the temple or the Tower of Babel, and there's really no in between. You know, you're building something, and it's construction either towards heaven or towards hell. There seems to be this dichotomy, right? And the more I explore this stuff, it's like, oh my goodness, like that seems to be fundamental to reality, right? And so I'm starting to see even, you know, heaven and hell are emergent. You know, they're not arbitrary. I mean, they are an emergent property of reality in some manner. I don't know if that's the correct language. I feel nervous saying something like that, but like that's kind of how it seems to me at this point, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's a there. Let's
right.
just put it that way.
Yeah,
it's a there. There's a there that you can't get away from. If you really start looking at things and understanding the structure of things.
Yeah.
The other day I had a conversation with a physicist who has developed a theory of the ether, which if he were correct, I mean, who knows? I certainly don't know. But if he were correct, that would mean that it would replace the theory of relativity.
Okay, interesting.
And what was I going to say about him? His theory has to be based on one fundamental assumption, and that is that there is at least a partially observable reality.
Interesting.
Because, you know, a lot of physicists are working with the idea that there is no observable reality.
Right.
It's really all just particles. And then we are somehow evolved to make sense of the particles somehow through something similar to the icon on our computer screen that shows us how to interact with the world, even though there's actually nothing there except particles.
Right.
But for his theory to work, there has to be at least a partially observable reality. And so I just thought that was so interesting, you know,
right. Yeah.
Even for the math to work in some theories, at least there has to be.
And I think we're going to bump up against, because so.
Yeah, I didn't want to derail you. I just
you're not. I mean, it
clarify a couple of things.
Ties into kind of where I wanted to take this anyway, because it's like, the sense I'm getting the more I explore this is that like the more I look down into the depths of particles and relationships between tiny things, it's like you get far enough down there, you might have this sudden realization that you're actually seeing God. And like you thought you were going all the way down, down, down to the bottom, but you're actually now seeing from the top. And it's a very jarring realization when you get there. And I think, you know, as we're talking about with like memory destabilization and reconsolidation, like that, I think that is going to start happening to lots and lots of people the more we're able to make relationships between things, you know, because like now we have like ChatGPT. It's a very powerful tool to make connections between things. But I think the more that happens, the more everyone is going to kind of come towards the center of understanding reality. And like, once we see reality more fully, I think a lot of people are going to have this kind of nauseating, horrifying experience of like, oh, I'm looking at a creation of God. And now what? You know? And I don't say that glibly. I say that with some trepidation, because I don't know if people are prepared for what they're going to see. You know what I mean? And I think that's going to be very destabilizing for some people's neural networks. And can I show you why I think that?
Yes, I totally agree with you, by the way, that we're coming to a place where everybody is starting to see the same thing.
Yes. And
because I noticed just a little bit of language from Jordan Hall the other day in a conversation, and a little bit of language from Jonathan Pageau, and some of the scientists I've been following, and they're all coming, they're not using the same language, and they're not coming from the same direction. And yet they're all starting to see the same thing that's very coherent with the structure that I've been seeing in my head and the structure you've been seeing in your head. These are all, they all have different grammars and different semantics, and yet they're all the same structure. So I think inevitably, if people keep their eyes and ears open, they're going to have to see that everybody can't be seeing the same picture if there's not a there there.
Yes. And then the big question is, what is the there that is there, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it feels to me like, yeah, I mean, we're in the middle of a real reformation. You know, people like to say like every 500 years or so, like that happens. Like, I think it's come, you know? And I mean, there's an atomic bomb that's about to go off in the world of philosophy. And because now that is so, there is such a quicker feedback loop between philosophy and culture, I think it's going to just spiral, you know? And that could be a beautiful thing, and it could be a very ugly thing. I don't know, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So here's something I wanted to show you. Because, okay, so this network right here, this grid of squares, it's flat, you know, it's just two dimensions. It's very simple. It's not very complicated, right? And I've been thinking about like, okay, this is fine, but like our minds are not quite storing information in this way, you know, because like where, like if you were looking at this, like where would the information about higher abstractions be? Because it's all on the same plane. And so it doesn't really make sense that you would have levels of abstraction, right? And so I've been thinking like, okay, how could you model that? And I think you could do it with something like this. You know, and so I've been really interested in the Platonic solids lately and fractals and this kind of stuff. And so imagine like, okay, like this. Like, let's say instead of a flat network like this, you had a 3D network, right? Where like each cell is like one of these vertices, right? And so you can have like a little pyramid, a little tetrahedron that's composed of tetrahedron. And then each of those could be decomposed into the same shape fractally as much as you want. You know, this could continue forever, right? And conceivably, you could very easily build a network that has this kind of topology, I guess you would say, this kind of structure. And now what you've created is a neural network that has inherent structure that is like levels, you know? And so the way I'm thinking about it currently is like this. Like, let's say, you know, so let's say I've got this. And so this is what we were just looking at, but it's like a top-down view, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so at the bottom layer, you've got, let's say the bottom layer is this layer one, right? It's going to be these right here. Right. And so, well, and all this. Okay.
Okay. I just lost your cursor. What are you pointing at right now?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was doing that with my finger on the screen. So, and so it's like, you've got all these little vertices at the bottom, you know, these three for this one, and these three, right?
Oh, now, I still can't find your cursor. I'm looking at the large image here under.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Let me, new share. Let's go to paint. Okay, my bad. Are you seeing?
Yes, okay. Now I can see it.
let me undo what I just did. Okay, so let's say that your first layer is going to be these points, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so I could move between these, right? And so this is kind of like the flat network that we were just looking at with like the grid of squares, right? But then let's say, okay, you know, again, this is a top-down view. And so if I want to go up like towards the higher part, That's kind of like traveling from like this point to this point, if that makes sense, right? So like let's represent that with a different color. So now this is my second layer of the hierarchy, which is going to be these three things, right? And then we can also have third layer, which in this case is just the center, right? And so now if information is traveling through the network, it can stay on the same plane and travel around that. So like let's say information started, down here, it could just stay going along the bottom of the network and just doing all this kind of stuff, right? And that would be fine. But what if at one point it decided to go up the hierarchy towards, the higher level of abstraction? It would travel up this thing. And now we've suddenly gone from level one to level two, right? And you'll notice at level one, there's more vertices. At level two, there's fewer. At level three, there's fewer, right? And so as you're going up, it's like you're compressing information more and more and more until you get to the most compressed, right? And in some sense, once you get to this green node in the middle, that's the center of your network. And it's the compressed version of everything that has arrived at that point. And so all the information you've ever processed, if it's gone up into those higher levels of abstraction, now it's going to be represented there. Okay. And so
That's
this.
exactly the same image as how the pixel of any photograph carries all the information of the photograph, or how one photon carries all the information of the universe.
Yeah. Yep.
Right?
And so, yeah, exactly. And so I think this kind of network is probably how real physical relationships manifest. I don't know a better way to put it. Because I think, you can get really into like, I don't want to go too deep down this rabbit hole because I think this is where it can get scary and dangerous for people. But it's like, you start exploring this and it's like, okay, well, this kind of thing relates to, I mean, this is what Gabe is working on, right? Like he's envisioning a torus with like two different things that are interacting with each other and all this stuff, right? And this gets into like sacred geometry and Kabbalah and all this stuff. Like people have been seeing these patterns for a very long time, right? Even before we understood physics and chemistry, And so there's something going on there, right? And so it's almost as if networks just work this way in general, right? And so what we have is there is a center of a network. And so your brain has a center, right? There is an idea that's at the top. You know what I mean?
Okay, so the center of the network is the idea that's at the top.
Yes, at the
Is that
top.
true? Is that true in coding also?
Well, it depends what you mean. I mean, so this is one critique I have of, I think like the AI researchers, I'm not super into AI, but like my sense is that I don't think they're necessarily designing with these kinds of structures in mind. But I think those structures probably naturally emerge. And so however they trained ChatGPT, it probably has a center in some manner. Even if they didn't explicitly design the network in this way, I think probably what emerged was something like this. And so I
Well,
think it
if
probably
there is
does.
no center, then basically there would be no constraint. And if there's no constraint, then there's nothing to tie anything together. There would just be all this disparate information. There would be no cohesive focus or attention or ability to synthesize ideas. So there has to be different levels of, there at least have to be some different centers. There has to be center somewhere.
Yeah.
Ideas have to synthesize around something,
Yes.
right?
Yes, exactly. And so I think it's inevitable. It's emergent and inevitable that these networks have a center, right? So then if that's true, which I can't prove, but that's what I'm going to be working on. If that's true, then the question becomes, what are we putting at the center? What are we putting at the top of our hierarchies? Because this applies to our minds, it applies to the AI we're creating, it applies to everything that emerges according to these patterns, right? And if we're not aware that this is how it works, if we're just like you know, kind of bopping along in life and thinking like, whatever, who cares? Like, you will have a center. Something will enter that space and control the center. Do you want it to be God or do you want it to be a demon? You know? And I guess this has just been really on my mind a lot lately, because now that I'm seeing this stuff, it's like, okay, I mean, this is inevitable, it seems. This is just how it works. This is how everything works. And what is it that we're putting at the center of our networks? Because I think you could even model society according to these kinds of networks. Like, even though we're not aware of it, there probably are topological centers of our little hierarchies. And if you keep going up and up and up that topology, what is at the top? What's at the center? I don't know, you know? It would be a really interesting exercise, I think, to like try to like, you know, model Twitter followers according to this kind of structure and that sort of thing, you know? But that's beyond.
Well, let's go up as many levels as we can go and say what's at the center, okay? Because what that complete picture is in terms of reality is going to show up fractally everywhere else. So, Savilla King's been working for a long time on Robert Pirsig's idea of quality, trying to really understand what it is that he's talking about there. And because I haven't done as much work as she has, but I've had a number of conversations with her, my own take on it would be that quality is that thing that's drawing us upward. There's something drawing us upward towards that center. And quality has to be related somehow to that thing that Jordan Peterson's always talking about, where when all the different themes of the music stack up on top of each other and you get that rush of meaning, this is where meaning resides. And I think in our daily lives, the small picture that we get of that is whenever we are faced with this infinite field of possibilities, but we're guided by whatever our focus or attention is, we're guided forward along a path, and we take one step after another. And some of those steps, we feel closer to that sense of meaning, and some steps make us feel further away, or sometimes they're catastrophic, right? We're always butting up against that sense of meaning or quality in the universe. And I think that's the communication that we get from whatever that center is about whether we're getting closer to the good center or further away from the good center. And so there's something there about the sense that we have of when we are making contact with reality versus not.
And I think that's a good way to put. I'm glad you brought up that. I mean, Esther Meek, Contact with Reality, Michael Polanyi, all that stuff. The idea that, like, she calls it subsidiary focal integration, where it's like you have all this stuff on the outside. In fact, you can map that exactly to this. You could think of subsidiary focal integration as like, okay, you've got all the red information at the bottom. You could think of that as like just the raw input. So the information coming from the tendons up through the spinal cord towards the brain, right? That's all just the raw information at the bottom of the hierarchy of your network. But then as you integrate it into higher and higher levels of abstraction, it's going to get compressed down to, yeah, some kind of something as you're making meaning of it. And so it's not just happening, it's happening as you're making meaning of it, which is interesting. And then it's like once you have that, you can start going the other direction. You know, you can start seeing through that, and all the other stuff will remain on the edges and it'll get integrated naturally. You know, it's as you start engaging with the world, you're gonna naturally engage with the world through the higher levels of abstraction, even though what's actually happening is your body is touching things and you're seeing stuff and you're hearing things. And it's like the bottom of the hierarchy and the top of the hierarchy are like meeting in the middle, you know?
Well, that's so beautiful, Ryan. I mean, it has to be that way.
It has to be. It's
It
inevitable.
has to be. There's no other way that one being could communicate with another being without there being this kind of interface of the higher levels of abstraction.
Right.
And yet, because of the higher levels of abstraction, because our underlying sensory input is unique to each of us, the way that we abstract up to the higher levels makes it much more difficult to communicate to the other person, because you're communicating abstraction to abstraction.
Yeah, exactly.
Like bark to bark, right?
Right.
Instead of getting into the center of the tree.
Yeah.
So then you have to decompose it or destabilize it out into the parts again in order to be able to try to communicate what's happening down at the lower levels.
Yep. And, right? And it's like, that seems to be what's happening in spaces. Like, for example, a conversation between, you know, like a Paul Vanderclay and a Jonathan Peugeot and a John Verveke. It's like, there's some manner in which these three people are talking about very similar stuff, but you know, they've stored different things in the higher levels of abstraction somewhat, but some of it's similar, you know, and they have different language, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Paul has his Protestant language, you know, Jonathan has his language, and John has his language, you know, but they can meet in the middle somehow and understand each other by adopting a shared language. And you know, this reminds me of the story of the Tower of Babel. It's like there was a shared language, and because of that, they were able to build higher and higher. Now, for whatever reason, God was unhappy with what they were building towards, and so he chose to scatter the languages, right? But we're getting back to a place where we are coming back to a shared language, and that's going to keep happening more and more with like ChatGPT and these kinds of AI tools. Because now, like, I don't know anything about neuroscience, I don't know anything about physics, but I can take these abstract ideas and I can tell ChatGPT, like, hey, here's like an idea that's in my head. Like, can you tell me if there's anything in physics that matches this? And it'll go beep, boop, boop. Oh yeah, here's like five different things. And I can go, okay, well, number three is actually what I'm talking about. That's interesting. And now I've got the language, right? And so these AI chatbots are going to be like the bridge, the shared language between all this stuff. And so now we're coming back to a shared language, and we're starting to rebuild a Tower of Babel again, right? And so we are enacting this pattern. And, you know.
Okay, so let's just talk for a second about what went wrong at the Tower of Babel.
I don't know. It's been on my mind. I don't know. I have no idea.
Well, Karen, as you were just talking about it now, what popped into my head, and I hadn't really thought about this before, I don't think, is their motivation. Their motivation was all off, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was the same motivation as in the garden. We will be like gods.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So I don't think there's anything fundamentally, I don't think there's anything fundamentally evil about building tall buildings.
Right.
What's your purpose in building the tall building? And similarly, I don't think there's anything fundamentally evil about abstracting up from the lower levels of our sensory input,
right,
to develop ideas. And even to try and get closer and closer to truth. I think that's the structure that God built into reality, is that hunger and thirst for righteousness of wanting our will to be in line with God's will.
Yeah.
Is if our search for truth is powered by that hunger and thirst for righteousness of having our will be in line with God's will, then our search for truth, for going up and up and up to higher levels, closer to truth, will be navigated with what Nima Arkani Hamed calls the morality of, you know, like the morality of fundamental physics. In order to do science and get truth out of it, you have to approach it with an absolute pristine morality. Because the minute that you break morality and you try to do something duplicitous or in a sleazy fashion, or try to be clever, or any of those things, you're going to be tweaking your data and you're not going to get to the truth. So in the same way that an artist, when they're painting a painting, they have to always be faithful to the original vision if they want to get back to the original vision, they have to be faithful to the original vision. Maybe that's where the consolidation and the reconsolidation comes in. Is there some sort of faithfulness?
Well, this might be a good point to segue. So this is kind of my, you know, my idea world. But the reason I ended up here was because of my own, like, you know, me trying to understand, like, how can I heal from some pain, right? And it's a long story. I don't necessarily want to go super deep into it. And we've talked at length about that in past videos, right?
Well, I mean, if you want to, I can link to the videos.
Yeah, that'd be great. In
the description section.
But what I came to recently was I kind of came to, like, the core of my anxiety was a deep fear of reality, a deep fear of God, a deep fear of the future. It's very vague. It's hard to put into words, but it was like, I just fundamentally didn't feel safe at all in general. And that's from a very long time ago for a variety of reasons, most of which I don't even understand. You know what I mean? So it's not even something I necessarily know how to talk about. But what I found, essentially what happened to me as I kept exploring all this stuff and I kept getting closer and closer to what felt like something that had so much explanatory power, was I started seeing God. And once I saw God in all this, it was like, oh my goodness, I can't look away now. Like, I've seen what I've seen. And what I've seen as I've looked down into particles is, this is all God's creation. This is all from the mind of God. And now... And because I've been so afraid of God my whole life, it's been like, what do I do with that? I can no longer look away. I can no longer pretend that that's not the case. And now that I've seen it and I'm being confronted with it, now what? Because, you know, it almost felt like I had a decision to make. Either I'm going to trust this God or not. You know, I'm gonna go towards him, or I'm gonna run away from him, you know. And I had this experience recently where it felt like I finally had this realization about all this stuff, it like triggered like a ton of anxiety, you know. And I think it was actually a moment of pretty large memory destabilization in my mind, because I think basically the cognitive part of me had always been kind of an atheist and kind of like, well, I don't really believe in God, or I'm going to remain undecided about that question, because the emotional part of me was so terrified of God. And I think some of this potentially comes from my kind of fundamentalist upbringing, and I'm not bashing it, but I think a critique I have of it is that when they were talking about hell, it was very emotional. And so the emotional part of my brain was trained to be terrified of God, anxiety, anxiety, anxiety. Like, reality is fundamentally scary. God is fundamentally scary. But when we talked about the love of Jesus and the love of God, it was very like robotic, cognitive, beep, boop. Well, according to these rules, God loves you. And it's like, okay, now you've trained a brain to be very, very, very bipolar. Like, I was conditioned in that fundamentalist church to be bipolar, right? In quite a literal sense, almost, right? Let me stop this share. And
I love the way that you laid that out, by the way. I mean, that's, yeah.
And so it's not that what they were telling me, I mean, they were just preaching the Bible, right? And so it's my beef is not with them per se, or the content of what they were telling me. My beef is, okay, you taught me to be very segmented. They were very much Cartesian dualists in terms of like, be afraid in your emotions and your body, but love God in this very kind of like, not emotional sense, but a very cognitive sense. And so now my brain has these two separated parts, right? Mm-hmm. And it's almost like, in some sense, all my body pain has been from that part of my brain that's terrified of God. And the part of me that's exploring theology and philosophy and computer science and networks and memory and blah, 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 this little corner part of me is the cognitive part. that is basically an atheist because it's so terrified of what this other part of the network knows, right? And so as I've been getting to the center, and you know, Gabe Stuckey's work has been kind of pivotal to that, I've been rapidly getting to the center, and I had this moment of what I think was massive memory reconsolidation in my brain, or massive memory destabilization, you know, where suddenly the cognitive part of me saw without a shadow of a doubt that the shape of reality is a creation of God. I don't know how to put it into words yet, but like I saw God in the particles in a way that I cannot unsee. And so suddenly I'm confronted with, I can no longer ignore this terrified part of me. And now what do I do? And so that was the kind of atomic bomb for my mind, you know? And now everything is... And so, you know, according to the memory consolidation research, you have about 5 hours to like, it's going to restabilize somehow in 5 hours or so, you know? And that's probably not a hard and fast number. That's probably dependent on all kinds of variables. We don't really understand that yet. But I guess I was deeply aware in that moment, oh my goodness, like I literally, like in this moment, have a decision to make. Like I've seen this now. And so now what? Am I going to trust God? Am I going to run from God? Am I going to try to keep denying God? And I think I was deeply aware, like this is going to affect the emotional valence of my life going forward. Maybe not in a permanent way. Like I can probably still, because essentially memory reconsolidation is just repent and believe. It's just change your mind, right? Be willing to let go of how you've currently mapped things out and remap it. You know, that's all it is. And so it's like, okay, I had this deep moment of repentance that I was not prepared for, you know, because I was confronted with all this. And then I felt like I had to decide, okay, what do I think about this God, you know? And it was a pretty terrifying experience, Karen, if I'm honest, because I had so much anxiety. I was not ready for this, you know? And the thing that kind of brought me back down to earth was thinking, okay, I opened the book of John in the Bible and I started reading, because this is what I've done in the past when I have these moments. And it's like, okay, I can't prove any of this is true in the same way that I can prove that I have my cup here, but let me read it anyway. So in the beginning, you know, so I'm reading all this stuff and I start thinking about the nature of this Jesus. And, you know, my friend Austin tells me frequently, Ryan, Jesus says, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And that has really stuck with me lately because it's like, okay, this Jesus is someone that I would want to spend time with. This Jesus is someone I would trust. This Jesus is someone that I would love for people to live according to his principles. I think we would have a much better society if we were all submitted to these principles, you know? And so I started thinking, okay, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. What he's saying is, it like, if he's good, if his principles are good, if he's trustworthy, he seeing him is to see the one who created all this stuff, you know? And that was like the thing that helped that terrified part of me have a little bit of hope, have a little bit of trust and go, okay, maybe, you know? And I realized at this point, this was no longer a matter of, this was no longer an intellectual problem. This was very much an emotional problem. It was a trust problem, you know? Belief was no longer a cognitive thing for me. Belief was very much an emotional thing for me, you know? And in this moment, and I started having this, you call it whatever you want, a vision or, you know, internal family systems would call it like inner child work, you know, but like I imagined my little tiny 5-year-old self being in this just blank, empty, white eternity space alone and terrified, you know, and then I see this God coming towards me. You know, my friend Austin and Haley, they got me this little print, which is, you know, it's the United States made of sheep, if you can see that.
Yes.
You know? And it's a little sheep that's run off and the shepherd's running at it, you know? And so in this moment, I'm having this little vision or this little thing, this internal construct of like, that's what's happening to me. I'm this scared, frightened little kid, and this God is coming towards me. And I have to decide, like, what do I think about that? You know, do I trust him? Is he going to destroy me? Is he going to love me? You know? And I just kept thinking, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. It's like, if Jesus is God, or seeing Jesus, I've seen God, then maybe I can trust that God is good and that reality is good. And this all means something, and that this all is deeply meaningful, and that there's purpose and there's structure and there's hope. And it was like such a grounding experience, Karen, you know, because now, and then I allowed that vision to just play out. You know, I saw this God coming towards me, this Jesus coming towards me, this little inner version of me being willing to work through the fear and embrace him and trust him and hear from him, Ryan, you've been adopted. Like, you've been adopted by my Father. My Father's good, and we're going to go to him. And, you know, and so I could keep going with that vision, but you get the idea. And it's like, okay, so let me calm down. What happened in that moment, as far as I'm concerned, is what in the counseling world they would call resourcing. It's like I installed a stabilizing, grounding, hopeful thing at the top of, or near the top of my memory network. Because remember, this is kind of, I mean, this is me connecting with basically everything, my whole view of reality. My whole view of reality was destabilized at this point in my neural network, as far as I can tell. And the resource that got installed at that point was this beautiful, hopeful, calming, relaxing, like, moment of like, you've been adopted, you're a son of God, you're deeply loved, reality is good, my Father's good, let's get in the car, I'm going to take you to him, you're going to live there, you're no longer going to be abandoned in this weird empty space, you know. And now that that resource is established in near the top of my hierarchy of abstraction, it's like, that is the resource that I can tap into to heal my body. And, you know, if I didn't understand the neuroscience, I'd be calling it a miraculous healing. It probably is anyway, but that's another conversation for later. But like, literally, I've been able to like touch the parts of my body that have been in pain for years and years and do memory reconsolidation with my mind and my body, like quite literally. I mean, not in like some weird woo sense, but like very much according to the neuroscience research. Like, I can touch my body, I can engage the parts of my network that are connected with that pain, and then I can access that resource that I've installed, which is the vision of me getting picked up by Jesus and told, you've been adopted, you're a son of God, we're going to him. You know, and then I had to keep working through that vision. Like, in the vision, it's like I get dropped off and I see the Father in the distance. And it's like the story of the prodigal son. It's like, okay, at this point, I'm still expecting, like, I need to just beg for mercy. And maybe he'll take me as a slave. Maybe. And then what happens is he sees me and he throws his hands up and he starts running and he's like excited. He's joyful. He's like, my son has returned, you know? And like, to have that, I can't describe to you, Karen, to have that as like a resource near the top, or maybe at the top of my hierarchy of abstraction at this point, is like, it's everything can feel hopeful now, you know? I don't have to mistrust this God. I don't have to mistrust reality. I don't have to see reality as something that's fundamentally scary and evil and chaotic and meaningless and nihilistic. Like, I don't have to see the world like Nietzsche did, right? And to have that experience is like incredible. And so anyway, so I can now engage with the parts of my body that hurt and then do this kind of bilateral stimulation thing, going back and forth between that pain and the hopefulness and the peace and the relaxation of that vision. And as I bring those together, that one is the one that wins out and the pain goes away. And so I've had some moments where like, I've literally been able to like release huge portions of my muscle tension in a way that anybody would consider miraculous. You know, if I chose not to tell them, hey, I can also explain how this works. You know what I mean? That's a really curious thing to me. And that's, and I think these are the kinds of things that we're going to start discovering in this weird meta modern era or whatever, because it's like, what is that? You know, anybody could listen to this video and go, oh, that's just whatever. He chose to believe something and it's beneficial for him, good for him, whatever. Or you could see that as no. I mean, this, this is Jesus healing me, like quite literally, you know. How do you want to interpret it? Not my problem, you know, but I hope people will deeply consider what's happening here and try it for themselves, you know, and not because I mean, it's inevitable. Like I don't want to be too dramatic here, but like time is running out in the sense that we are building our Tower of Babel. We are coming towards that center. As we were talking about earlier, like all the philosophy is coming together into the center, and like people are going to have these massively destabilizing experiences. I think these kinds of experiences are going to start becoming more and more common. And what are you going to install as a resource? Are you going to install Nietzsche? Are you going to install, you know, humanism? Like, what are you going to put at the top of your hierarchy? I mean, people will be forced into these decisions, you know? And I don't know.
Wow. As you were speaking, this song came into my mind. You maybe have heard it. It's an old one. He will change your name.
Mm-hmm.
You will no longer be called wounded, outcast, lonely, and afraid. The second verse slips my mind right now, but the final part is friend of God. You'll have a new name. And the other day I was reading a Substack from Spencer Clavin. Mm-mm. And he was talking about words and the importance of words, and that the name of God there are a lot of different names of God that are used in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. You know, Jesus is called by many names, and in the Old Testament he's the Prince of Peace and all of these things. But the name of God is that which we are all longing to know.
Yeah.
And so our whole life is longing to know the name of God, because the name is associated with the character.
Yes.
And the personality and the attributes of God. And we are longing to know that. And so in our lives, as we live our lives and we bump up into this contact with reality, we're learning more all the time about the name of God and who he really is. And if our experiences are negative experiences, when we kind of bounce off reality, we might be tempted to think, oh, God is not good. But yeah. Maybe it was our approach that was not good.
Yeah.
Maybe we're, and I don't mean that he demands that we approach him in a certain way. That's not what I mean at all. What I mean is, if you're bumping up against reality because you're taking steps that are not coherent with reality, then you're, you know, you're going to run into trouble. If you try to fly a plane with too much weight in it, the plane is going to crash. Yes. That's not some judgment of God against you. That's just the way gravity works.
Right.
And so there is a way that the world works, and this is why embodiment is so important. You can't come to conclusions with strictly philosophy. It has to be through the embodied nature of our experience, that he made us this way so that we could have contact with him, so that we could come to know his name.
Yeah. And I mean, exactly. It has to be embodied. And I think this is something that I desperately hope the AI researchers pick up on, because You know, again, going back to that grid, that network I was showing earlier with all the colors, like what was causing it to stay eternally alive was that stability, that balance, the balance of opposites that are listening to each other. That is how our body works, you know. My right side, you know, so like handedness, dominance, right? Like my right side, I'm right-handed. My brain is going to naturally kind of associate my own sense of identity with my dominant hand. And otherness is naturally going to get associated with the non-dominant hand, right? And so now essentially what I have is self and other as left and right side. And now it's like those opposites that need to dialogue with each other. And so like the way the body is structured with the left and the right side and the left and the right hemisphere and all that stuff is like embodied balancing that is natural. And it's not balancing just arbitrarily. It's like literally to stay upright, I have to stay balanced, you know? Like if I'm running, like they have to be in engagement with each other, right? And when imbalances happen, then things get wonky. You get pain, you get everything bad, you know? And so I think these networks, these AI we're creating need to either literally be embodied or at least model and simulate embodiment and balance in order to stay towards something that will actually be good and be not horrible and destroy us, you know? And
I was just thinking about your Sierpinski triangle picture and thinking, I don't even know what this means. Okay, this is just off the cuff. We know that the world, we know that the smallest things are quantum particles, and then after that we have protons and neutrons and electrons, and then after that we have atoms, and then we have molecules, you know, blah, blah, blah. Every one of those layers is, you know, so the very bottom of the Sierpinski triangle, but with, you know, made manifest hugely with the quadrillions of little triangles at the bottom. And then as you build up, and so the whole structure is composed of all these little small particles, but then those small particles are actually the next level of triangle would be, you know, and then the next level would be the molecules. And until you've just got one big triangle. And so the whole thing is one structure, but with many, many parts. All the multiplicity of parts are represented in that structure. But those parts are meaningless without the whole. You take any one of those little parts out of there, it's completely meaningless if it's not fitting into the whole. In the same way that if you have a photograph, you can take one pixel out of that photograph and set it over here. And you could do a lot of research on it and figure out exactly what color it is with your little ink dropper from, you know, Adobe. And you could figure out the size of it, and you can figure out how light or dark it is and all that kind of stuff. But it's just a thing. It has no meaning at all. But you plug it back into the painting, and now it's that little corner of the mountain that the sun is glancing off of in this beautiful landscape, right?
I was thinking about this yesterday because I live in kind of the Dallas area, and we were in the path of totality for the eclipse. I've seen partial eclipses before, and it was like, okay, that's kind of cool, but like this was a whole different experience. I don't know
Oh,
if you've ever seen one before.
I might have when I was a very young child, but obviously it would have been a long time ago, and I had to view it through a pinhole and a piece of cardboard. So.
Well, this was when you get to, like, I didn't realize this, but when you get to totality, the moon has actually entirely covered the sun. And so you're no longer seeing anything through those glasses. You can take them off and you're seeing something that, I mean, it's like the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. Like pictures don't capture it very well. It's like the moon is being crowned with the glory of the sun. It's just these rays that are shooting off, you know? And it was like, okay. So imagine in 2024, how are most people thinking about this? Oh, well, that's a big ball of gas out there being covered up by a big rock. And here's the math that made that work. That's pretty neat. That's so stupid. What Stupidity, what foolishness. Like, that's not what that is. You've completely misunderstood what that is. And like, I'm actually mad thinking about this. You know, it's like you've stripped all the meaning away from this incredible phenomenon, you know, and you've made it something stupid and ugh, repugnant to me, you know. That phenomenon is dripping with meaning if you will actually pay attention, you know. And
okay, let's see if I can find something. Whoops. Are you getting a echo from me?
I'm not. Let me move my mic away. Might be my problem.
Well, I think it was
So
probably
shouting
me.
is
Oh, there's share screen. Okay. Sorry, I'm going to show you something on share screen. Hopefully I can get to where it is.
Yeah, I'm seeing your browser.
Okay. This.
Oops.
I'm sorry. Can you see this picture in the center here?
Yep.
On the Twitter thing?
Yep.
Okay, get a look at this.
I've never seen it before.
You know what that is?
It's light through the leaves, right?
Yes, it's wherever there's a space between leaves on a tree, as the light comes through, it's like a pinhole camera representing the eclipse.
That's really
so this
interesting.
is the eclipse all over the sidewalk.
Yeah.
That was so beautiful.
Yeah.
Look at that. That's what light does. So each little beam of light is representing the eclipse for you in cascades of beauty everywhere. I just thought that was pretty cool.
And it's like, as an artist, you can appreciate like what's happening there, the beauty of what's happening, the meaning of what's happening there, right? Like, I think, you know, I've been thinking lately, the more I've gotten into exploring particles and networks and all this very like whatever math kind of stuff, I think C.S. Lewis at one point talks about like it's not the poets who tend to go crazy, it's the mathematicians and the logicians, right? And it's like, I think we are very imbalanced as a civilization. We need to rebalance towards the poets and the ones writing mythology and stories. Like, we need that kind of rebalancing in order to stabilize towards something like, you know, I think that's somehow related to the meaning crisis. You know, we've lost all of our stories, and the stories are what was balancing out our understanding of like physical reality, you know? And it's kind of inevitable, because like what caused that? As far as I can tell, it's the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment philosophers and scientists said, okay, let's throw out all the stories, let's throw out the narrative, let's throw out the mythology, let's throw out all that stuff, and let's just have this other thing, you know? And there were attempts to kind of rebalance it back. You know, the transcendentalists tried to like, okay, let's have this kind of like, woo, like, you know, engagement with reality, but it didn't really work, you know? And now we're in this weird spot of like, wherever we are now, you know, where all of our stories are basically meaningless and we're just kind of consuming ourselves. And we've become this kind of Ouroboros type situation where we're just collapsing inward. We're consuming ourselves. And it's like, we need something that's going to get us out of that. And I don't know what that is. I mean, ultimately, I believe it's Christ, you know, but we need to engage with Christ in a particular manner. We need to engage with reality in a particular manner. And we need to be thoughtful about what is that.
Well, you know, for all of the things that maybe Jordan Peterson hasn't seen yet, he has seen an awful lot. And one of the things that he's seen is that in order to move towards truth with any sense of not going insane, you have to have faith. You have to trust that being is good.
Yes.
And I think that's like just one of the fundamentals. I mean, as I've told you many times before, I had to come to that conclusion when my brother died in a plane crash, in a sudden event back in 1986. And I was a missionary living in Japan at the time, and I didn't have an opportunity to come back for his funeral or anything. And so I'm trying to fight through all the fear associated with that. He and I had many conversations, and he was very opposed to Christianity and just thought it was a bunch of mumbo jumbo. And so I had to try to deal in my heart and mind, what did that mean for his eternal destiny? It was a long struggle. For 6 months, I was just in agony.
Yeah.
But at the end of it, the conclusion that I came to, and I didn't come to it with any, it wasn't from thinking it through philosophically, it was from probably implanting in my heart over and over again those things you're talking about, you know, from the book of John or from the Psalms and things like that, is that God is good. And whatever the outcome of that is, God is good. And that has been a wonderful frame for me through a very imperfect life filled with lots of mistakes and lots of failures and everything else. But on the other side of all those things, if I always come back to that anchor point that God is good, that holds my cognitive framework together, you know. And it changes the world that I'm looking at, you know. I think it's Carl Friston who said that every organism has to bear within it a map of the microcosm in which it's situated.
Yeah.
A microcosm of the environment in which it's situated.
Mm-hmm.
So that map, first of all, I think that's a remarkable statement, because what that's really saying is the map precedes the image of your environment is necessary for your existence within the environment, which means that it has to be fundamental somehow.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know. I mean, to me, it's a very mysterious statement. I haven't thought my way all the way through to the bottom of it, but the map that I have of my environment affects what that environment is to me. So if my map is wrong, I'm going to fall over the cliff.
Yeah.
But if I have the right map, then I know exactly how to walk along the path and enjoy the view instead of falling off.
Yeah.
Right? So if my map is based on the goodness of God, then I'm going to see the world through that lens, and it makes life a whole lot more joyful. And not that I'm joyful all the time, because I have days when I don't have a good map. You know, I keep going back to the old maps, drag out the old tapes running in your head, you know.
Yeah.
I have lots of tapes from when I was a kid that I could run day in and day out, but they're not very useful.
Yeah.
Much more useful map to remember that I can put my hand out and my Father will take my hand and walk with me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and to come full circle, Karen, it's like the reason we're having this conversation, as I've told you in the past, is because I was in the pits and I had a conversation with Paul Vanderclay, which, by the way, I cheated. I wrote a computer program to constantly check his calendar so that I could be the one that would get that spot. I lowered myself through the roof because I wanted to talk to him, you know? And you left a comment on that video that basically the long and short of it was, Ryan, God is good. And that's what's going to help you come to grips with reality. And here we are, you know, I mean, in some sense that launched me on a journey of trying to understand some things that I was ignoring. And it culminated in me confronting, yes, Ryan, you don't believe God is good. And you were terrified of God. What are you going to do about that? You know? And it's good to actually believe, you know, I feel like I actually believe now, and I don't know if I've felt that before, and it's changing me physically, it's changing me emotionally. I'm a much better friend. I'm a happier person. It's like the proof is in the tasting of the pudding, right? Like I'm becoming a much healthier, happier person. Much more grounded, much more hopeful. It's like, call it a cognitive crutch if you want, you know, new atheists, but like, I don't care. Like we're all going to be confronted with this, because we live in reality, you know, like you're going to have to decide what you think about reality. And
well, to me, one of the most beautiful things about this is the sense of how important time is. Because what is that now? 3 years ago? 4 years ago?
Yeah, two or three, something like that. I don't know. I lose track.
If at that point you had been able to snap your fingers and instantly believe in God, then all your troubles would have been over, supposedly. But all the stuff that's happened in the intervening 3 years would never have happened. You never would have learned all the things you've learned and shifted gears and started going to school to learn about cognitive science and psychology and all these things and come up with this new approach to these ideas that is going to help many, many people. And so all that suffering that you went through, it's just unbelievable to me. All the suffering you went through confronting that problem, that anomaly, is what brought all this beauty out for you and for others. And I mean, I feel the same way about something that happened in our lives 9 years ago. If I could have fixed it instantaneously, I would have in a heartbeat because it was so painful. And yet the intervening 9 years have been so powerful in transforming all of us who've been involved. And I never would have started this channel if that had not happened. And I mean, there's just so many things, you know? So we underestimate the beauty of, I guess I just have to say, of suffering.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds really pat. That really sounds bad.
But it's true. And it's like that is, you know, I think you and I have maybe talked about this before, but like, as I've been working through, you know, I've had a lot of resentment to repent of, you know, become very bitter over the years. And I kind of felt like, well, my life has been ruined because of XYZ. Like I didn't get married at 20 like everyone else in Alabama, and now my life is off track and I can't recover those years. And I would see that verse from the Bible that was like, the Lord will restore the years that the locusts have eaten. And I would think, it would make me so angry because it's like, that can't happen. That can't happen. It doesn't work that way. Well, now I don't know exactly what was intended there, but from a neuroscience perspective, it's like memory reconsolidation actually replaces the emotional valence of memories. And so all that stuff I've been bitter about, it's like, as it transforms, it's like, I remember the fact that I was bitter, but I don't remember the bitterness. I cannot recall those feelings. Like the past has been rewritten for me in my experience. And it's like all the memories that were locked away with that anxiety are now getting recovered. And I'm remembering all these fond memories of my childhood that I didn't have before. And it's the years are being restored, you know? And it doesn't change, you know, especially like if I was dealing with like the grief of the loss of a loved one, you know, that's going to be a continual pain. You can't just like, make that go away. But like, these things do get transformed in some deep manner that actually matters, you know? And I'm starting to think like, man, maybe I have fundamentally misunderstood the world in some ways, you know? It almost feels like I was upside down and now I'm reversing, you know? I've been oriented completely away from God because I'm afraid of him. And now I have turned and looked and seen, oh wait, he's actually good. I am actually happy about this, you know? And I don't know where all this is headed, but it's good not right now, you know?
It's such a privilege to have been able to walk along at least part of this with you, Ryan.
Yeah.
And I've learned so much from you and from talking with you and just interacting with you. And you have a beautiful way of listening and incorporating what you hear and giving back. So it always feels like Dialogos with you. I mean, even back when you were really struggling, it still felt like Dialogos. It still felt like there was a meeting there somehow in that conversation with you. And I've, it's been a real privilege to be able to have those conversations. And I will put them in the description section so that other people can share them as well.
Cool. Thank you, Karen.
If you remember one particular one where you, I think it may be the second to the last one that we had where you talked in greater detail about the physical aspect of your journey.
Yeah, it was probably too
dealing with the physical pain.
Yeah.
So we've actually talked probably a half a dozen times, maybe.
Yeah, I think this might be number six or something.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we know each other.
And I'm glad you connected with
me. I was thinking about this the other day. You and I hung out in I was on a road trip and I came to California, right? And
yeah.
I went to dinner with or brunch with you and your husband. And that was a really special experience for me because I did, you know, I showed up and I was kind of nervous and I started off the conversation with like philosophy nonsense and y'all were just like, Ryan, tell me about your family, you know? And it was so disarming because I was like, oh wait, these people actually want to be friends and they want to love me, you know? And it's been cool to have, you know, I'm doing estuary now in this little area in Dallas, and it's kind of the same way there. It's like, wow, I'm meeting these people in person. We're actually getting to know each other and we're actually learning to love each other in person, and it's cool, you know. But on that note, Karen, I'm my buddy Austin that I talked about earlier, the one who told me that if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. I'm meeting him for dinner, so I should probably go.
Yeah, I gotta go too.
All right.
Really good talking to you.
Thank you. You too, Karen. Bye. All right, bye-bye.